Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from Google's Making and Science Initiative. They believe that passion for science and creative problem solving is key to addressing the challenges of today and tomorrow. Young scientists and makers can get started at g.co/makingscience. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Replication studies, studies that you do over again, are like the green leafy vegetables of the research world. Not the most exciting thing on the plate, and occasionally difficult to stomach, despite their healthy reputation. For example, a few years back, an influential study showed that the more committed people felt to their partner, the more likely they were to forgive them. Well, hey, that certainly feels true, no? There's a certain truthiness to that. But researchers know that in order to make a concrete case for that idea, they really need to rigorously test it. More studies are needed. But here's the rub. Research journals don't want to publish follow-up studies. But now a group of psychologists has set out to make replication more palatable. A new series of papers called Registered Replication Reports is re-examining high-profile psychology experiments, like that study of forgiveness and relationships, to see if results hold up. And in many cases, they do not. My guest, Dan Simons, is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois and co-creator of Registered Replication Reports. Joining him is Barbara Spellman, professor of law at the University of Virginia and former editor-in-chief of the journal Perspectives in Psychological Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having us
on. Yeah, great to be here.
You're welcome. Dan, give us an idea. What are Registered Replication Reports?
Sure. So registered replication reports are a new kind of paper, and the idea is to develop a careful protocol to exactly or as close as possible replicate an original finding. So what we do is develop the protocol, the materials, the methods, the analysis plan in advance in collaboration with the original authors of the study. And then we put out a call for other labs to follow that protocol and then publish all of those results together.
And the registered part means that you have registered what?
So, yeah, the idea of pre-registration is you've probably heard for clinical trials how a lot of them will be planned in advance and specified in advance so that you know how they're going to be designed and how they're going to be analyzed. That's the whole idea of registration. You're specifying in advance what you're going to do and how you're going to do it so that after the fact, there's no question about, say, cherry-picking data from the study or reporting some of the results and not others. Everything is specified in advance and planned out in advance.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this, the outcome of the replication that was announced this week about relationship forgiveness.
Yeah, so there are two interesting things here. So first, there's a large literature showing that there is a relationship, an association between how committed you are in your relationship and how you respond to betrayals. So that relationship is fairly solid, and we actually, as part of this replication report, we confirmed that relationship, that association. What was interesting about this study is that we were replicating was that it was the only study in that literature that tried to actually vary people's commitment to their partner and then measure how that affected their betrayal. So they actually tried through a manipulation where you had people think about their relationship either in terms of how committed they were or how independent they were, and then looked to see if that would change how they respond to betrayal. So it was an experimental manipulation as opposed to just a correlation.
Mm-hmm. But yet 4 out of the 5 studies you've looked at so far could not be replicated.
Yeah. So, and I should say going in with all of these studies, we're actually selecting studies for which we expect there to be some result, some effect, but there's some uncertainty about it. So this one was really important because it was the only one that did that causal experiment. But we expected going in that there would be an effect there. And what was interesting was that the manipulation itself didn't work. Mm. Right? So the attempt to manipulate how committed people were, that part didn't work, which makes it kind of hard to interpret what the failure to find any effects on betrayal meant.
Dr. Spellman, these reports are published in the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science. But historically, journals, as I said, they don't want to publish replications. What is that what drove you guys to get on board?
Yes, in part. Because there was no real way to consistently examine previous findings, journals don't want to be publishing the same thing over and over. You want to get the first study, you want to believe it's correct, and then you want to be able to move on from it. But unless people do it again in other situations, in other contexts, with other materials, how do we know how robust and generalizable it really is?
So, you know, is that then a mythology about science? We hear that the definition of science is reproducibility. But if there's no one reproducing it, how do we know about the veracity of what we've discovered?
That's a funny question. Actually, people are trying to reproduce it. It's just that the reproductions, if you will, don't get published. So, for example, if one of my students reads a really interesting paper in a journal and says, wow, this is a great finding. We ought to study it more. Let's find out whether this matters or that matters. Under what conditions does it hold? They run into my lab and I say, what a great idea. The first thing we should do is replicate that finding. So we do. We run the study again and we say, okay, that works. Let's try some other stuff. So the other newer stuff might get published, but the original thing that just says, yeah, it worked the first time, doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, how do original study authors feel about having their research reexamined?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are a couple of ways you could think about this. One is, at some level, it's kind of an honor to say your study is important enough that we really need to know how robust it is. Is it consistent across a whole bunch of cultures and societies and languages? So on the one hand, it's saying, yes, this is important work. This is something we really need to know about. But it's also, of course, scary to any original author because nobody wants to be wrong. And there's always a possibility that the result will turn out not to have been as robust as we thought. So, of course, there's a risk in doing this. But what we found so far is that most of the original authors have been incredibly supportive of the process. That was certainly true in this most recent replication report of one of Eli Finkel's studies. He was incredibly helpful throughout and wrote a commentary about it that talked about how the process was an effective way of studying this. So I think most people recognize that this approach of a collaborative development of a protocol that is as accurate as we possibly can make it and gives us the best chance of showing the results as possible is a good way to go about this.
Mm-hmm. Is there go ahead, Dr. Spellman.
Yeah, but Ira, you put your finger really on something in the beginning that was troubling. And that is the early lead up to all this. Things were pretty contentious. And some people thought that the only reason somebody else would try to replicate their study is to show that they were wrong. They were really worried about that. And some people thought other people who would try to replicate studies were either only people who didn't have any ideas of their own or were somehow incompetent. So the lead up to this was really pretty ugly, where a lot of people were afraid of this whole replication thing. But now, with the replication reports in Perspectives and in some other journals following it along, we want it to get back to being the mainstream kind of thing that it probably was in earlier days.
So you're finding a change in mood? I mean, why now? What's happening in the field of psychology that made replicating experiments a priority?
Bobby, do you want to take that? Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Sure. There was this big confluence of things a few years ago, not only in psychology, but also really importantly in medicine and some of the other biological and social sciences, where people couldn't replicate each other's research, where various types of fraud were detected, although I want to say that I don't think that that's the major motivator for what's going on now. There were some things published that other people really very much disagreed with, whether they were well done or not. And so there was a bit of turmoil in the field. Plus, there are other people pointing at the way we use bad statistics.
Manipulating data, things like that.
Yeah, yeah. So many things were going on at once. And the funny thing is none of them were new. These complaints have been around for a long time. But the fact that so many of them were happening together, I think, is one of the reasons that pushed psychology to go through this new introspective phase, and then the fact that other fields were going through it too when we were made us think, oh, it's not just us, right? We're not in it alone. Mm-hmm. So it's been more collaborative now.
Dan, what's the future look like for replication in psychology from what Barbara says? It doesn't look like you're going to run out of things, out of topics.
Yeah, I mean, the goal obviously isn't to try and replicate everything under the sun because we don't need to go back to every single study and redo it. A lot of science does progress, so the things that are relevant to a field now may not be, or that were relevant to a field 20 years ago may not be relevant anymore. So one of the things we look to is whether the studies we're examining have what we call replication value. So are they still findings that influence the field? And would it change how we think about the mind and behavior if we had a better estimate of what this effect is? So I don't think there's an infinite amount of stuff that we need to go and replicate, but I do see this as one of the many ways that you can go about shoring up the field.
Well, is there one particular field that's more important or needs is crying out for attention now more than anything else?
I think what we've been seeing from a lot of different disciplines is that this is not a psychology-specific problem or even a subfield of psychology-specific problem. This is something that's an issue across all of the sciences, that there hasn't been enough of a focus on getting all of the results published. So if you look at what's published in our journals, almost everything that's published is statistically significant, which means that things that didn't work don't end up in the literature. And that's true across pretty much every discipline that publishes and uses statistics. So I wouldn't say that there's any one particular subfield that needs fixing.
I have a tweet came in from Ted Pavlik who thought about my next question. I was thinking the same thing. Where is the money coming from? These are, you know, expensive studies.
Yeah, fortunately, so far the ones we've been looking at haven't been incredibly expensive studies. And we have a very generous grant that comes through the Center for Open Sciences to the Association for Psychological Science from the Arnold Foundation. And they've been highly supportive of replication research for years now. So they've been supporting most of these studies, which for the most part aren't that expensive. If we were, for example, trying to replicate a large-scale study of neuroimaging, of fMRI, we'd run out of money immediately. It's just too expensive. But the sorts of things we're doing are fairly easy to do, and most labs can cover the basic costs themselves.
That's not to say that these other people shouldn't be looking at their own work, even psychiatry,
absolutely,
which would involve critical drug tests and things like that.
Absolutely. If that's the big issue, is that often the NIH and other sort of government funding agencies will fund a big clinical intervention, for example, but then there's never money to go back and do the same thing again. People want to spend the money on new things.
Maybe you'll be changing that today. You never know. Dan Simons, professor of psychology, University of Illinois, co-creator of Registered Replication Reports. Barbara Spellman, professor of law, University of Virginia, former editor-in-chief of the journal Perspectives in Psychological Science. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Have a great weekend. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the connection between the ecosystems and species from the bottom up. The microbiome. Yeah, it's really all over the place. We'll talk about why that is after this break. Stay with us. Support for Science Friday comes from Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, professional blog, or an online store, it's all easy with Squarespace. Creating your own website with Squarespace is a simple, intuitive process. They offer beautiful templates with customizable settings. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. Squarespace is trusted by hundreds of thousands of savvy shop owners around the world. They get the tools they need to track inventory, process orders, and send custom emails in one intuitive interface. Squarespace has 24/7 customer support. No matter how technical your problem or trivial seeming your question, the customer care team is always online to assist you. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter the offer code SCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, set your website apart. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you hold your hands out in front of you, everybody do that now, yeah. Not what if you're driving. They look pretty similar. They're the same size. You clasp them together, and they line up. But if you look closely at your palms, and I mean really close up, there's a big difference. Over 80% of the bacteria on your right hand are not found on your left hand. That's right, 80% difference in bacteria from one hand to the other. Microbially speaking, your hands don't have that much in common. Things aren't always what they seem when you take a microbial perspective of the world. You can see new connections, not only within your own body, but between species and even systems. And the idea of the microbiome has only taken shape within the past decade. We haven't been talking about it for that long. That is the subject of my next guest's new book, and it's one of our favorite topics on Science Friday. Ed Young is the author of the new book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and a Grander View of Life. He's also science writer for The Atlantic. based in London. Welcome back, Ed.
Hi, all right. Good to be here.
Now, I know you've been reporting on the microbiome for 10 years, so give us a little thumbnail sketch of how it's all changed. I mean, it's really just blossomed, hasn't it, the studies
right.
of the microbiome?
It's really taken off in the last decade. I think microbes, for the first time in their history, have become fashionable. We're starting to understand just how profoundly they influence the lives of not just ourselves, but the entire animal kingdom, how they sculpt our bodies, how they shape our immune systems, how they influence our evolutionary opportunities and our genomes, and how they might profoundly affect our health. And I think all these discoveries are coming in from lots of different fields of science, from zoology, botany, immunology, neuroscience, and they're all coalescing together to give us this grander view of life that I talk about in the book.
Right.
The idea that, you know, everything that we see is greatly influenced by things we can't see.
And then the fact that our microbiome interacts with the microbiome in the soil or in the oceans, and they're all working together. It's just amazing.
It is. Our microbes connect us to the world around us. I'm sitting in one of your studios right now, bleeding microbes all over the place. Apologies to future guests. I'm also taking up microbes from the world around me. So yeah, there's this constant traffic that links us to the world around us. And there are so many parallels between the microbiomes of humans and those of other animals.
You know, you have a favorite microbe, a favorite bacteria that has actually been in the news about the Zika virus lately, called the Wolbachia. Tell us about why that's so important.
So Wolbachia was discovered in 1924, and no one really thought much of it. It lived in the bodies of insects. And then people realized that it was actually everywhere. It was in so many different species. And in some, it's a parasite that seems to have a thing out for males. It can transform males into females, or it kills males outright. In others, it's beneficial. It acts as a kind of dietary supplement. And it's beneficial to us, too, it turns out, because if you put Wolbachia in some species of mosquitoes, especially those that carry diseases like Zika or dengue, it stops them from becoming vectors. So scientists are now trying to release Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes into places that are rife with these tropical diseases. Once the bacteria is there, it's very good at spreading through natural populations. So the idea is, you release these mosquitoes, suddenly the wild population within a few months becomes infected with Wolbachia and therefore resistant to these viruses, these parasites that cause diseases in us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost every day we read something new about an experiment with the microbiome, and now this new idea of fecal transplants, making a pill out of it. And so far, there has not been much success in a pill version of the transplant, has there?
No, so the transplant itself, the idea of taking stool from a healthy donor to putting it in a sick one, I mean, the idea might still seem very unorthodox and gross to some people, but it has been incredibly successful at treating infections with this bacterium called C. diff, Clostridium difficile, a very weedy species that causes really severe cases of recurring diarrhea. But actually trying to find the particular microbes in that ecosystem, pulling them out and turning them into a standardized, well-defined pill that people can take, has proven to be very challenging. So we still don't entirely know what it is about the fecal transplant that makes it so effective. Which are the actors that are doing the job? I think that will happen. We'll probably work it out, but it just shows how complex these worlds inside us can be.
Because we take out a few dozen of the bacteria and we try them out, but it could be there are thousands in there, billions, right, of bacteria, and we don't know how they interact with one another.
That's right. We need to understand how they interact with each other. Are they competing, cooperating? Which work well together? How do they interact with us, their hosts, their immune system? These are the questions of ecology. You know, these are the questions that people who work in like rainforests and grasslands and coral reefs ask. And now we find ourselves asking these questions about our own bodies.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk to Ed Young, author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. I was struck by a bit of research I read last November that sort of drove a lot of this home. It looked at how immunotherapy, you know, trying to tweak the body's immune system to fight diseases, could be improved by a certain probiotic, by a certain bacteria.
That right.
Are you familiar with that?
I am, yeah. I wrote about it at The Atlantic. So these drugs are called checkpoint inhibitors, and they work by unleashing the immune system on tumors. And they've been such a promising advance in the realm of cancer. And then amazingly, we learned that the effectiveness of these drugs can depend on the microbes that we carry. So if you have mice that don't have any microbes at all, that they're sterile, these drugs don't seem to work. And it seems that certain species of bacteria are especially good at sensitizing the animals to these medicines. And I think it just goes to show that there are many cases where drugs that we use, where the medicines we use, vary in effectiveness depending on the microbes we have. So you could imagine that in the future, after a lot more work, you might be able to give people probiotics of carefully chosen bacteria that makes them more responsive to drugs. Or maybe in the nearer term, we might be able to look at a person's microbiome and say, okay, these medicines will work on you, these ones won't, so we're going to tailor your treatment that way.
Mm-hmm. Have we found a simple probiotic that everybody can take? Or I know that there was scientists have finally developed a successful one for goats.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that available to us?
That's a very specific case. So it's like it's this community of microbes, including one in particular, that detoxifies poisons in a particular plant called Lucaena, which allows cattle in Australia to dine on this very nutritious but otherwise toxic plants. Now, that's a very specific case where you're trying to do one particular thing, detoxify a particular chemical. And it works. It's pretty easy. The things that we're asking our own probiotics to do are much harder, which is why these products, even though they're quite good for some things like infectious diarrhea, seem to be a little underwhelming in terms of the reality versus the benefits that they're hyped to contain. But I think we will get to a point where we will be able to create well-chosen formulations of probiotics that do a lot of good for our health. But we're still only at the very beginnings of understanding these worlds inside us. So what governs which species live in which people, how to then manipulate those to actually improve our health. We're not quite there yet, but I think we're getting there with more work.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Adrian in Phoenix. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
So I'm wondering if the microbiome or the bacteria in the microbiome act somewhat like the, you know, animals and plants in the real world. Are there a predator and are there prey bacteria, or how do those interactions happen in the microbiome?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think all the interactions that you'd expect in a broader ecosystem, parasites, predation, competition, cooperation, you'll find those in the microbiome. You'll see species that produce nutrients that nourish each other. You'll see those that compete against each other. So there's this idea of colonization resistance, that we have this diverse array of bacteria in our bodies that stop those that are likely to cause disease from taking hold. There are all the concepts of broader ecology are applicable to us. Invasive species, you could think of bacteria that cause disease in that way. In the wider world, you get things like succession. So a new landscape will be colonized by, say, lichens and then shrubs and then trees in a very predictable way. And you see the same thing in like the gut of a newborn baby. You get waves of microbes coming in, rising to the to the fore and then fading away in very predictable patterns.
You mentioned in your book that some part of the mother's milk is not used to nourish the baby, but the developing microbiome.
This is one of my favorite microbiome stories. We see breastfeeding as obviously a way of nourishing an infant, but it turns out that about 10% of breast milk consists of these sugars that babies can't digest, and instead they are there to nourish microbes, to nourish specific strains that are specifically evolved to really efficiently eat these sugars, and in return they feed the baby's cells, they shore up the lining of the gut, they quench inflammation. And so a mother who's breastfeeding isn't just nurturing her infant, she's also creating this entire world in her baby's body, selecting which microbes get to live with her child.
Isn't the baby also sucking on, by sucking on the skin, getting mom's microbiome off the skin? Also,
yeah, that's part of it too. So this whole, all of these factors go into sculpting this ecosystem, like setting up this world that then sets the child up for the rest of its life.
It's fascinating. Let's go to the phones. Back to let's go to Brian in Orem, Utah. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Yes, this is my favorite part of each Friday.
Thank you.
I've learned a lot. I learned a lot about microbiome through this show. And last time I had antibiotic, system-wide antibiotic, has made me wonder, how does that affect the microbiome?
Good question. Yeah, we wonder about that too. When we're sick and we want to get an antibiotic, are we upsetting our microbiome?
Yeah, there's loads of studies now showing that antibiotics, you know, because they do kill bacteria, do have some negative effects on the microbiome. They seem to change it, as you would expect. You know, they are very broad brush weapons. They're kind of like nukes rather than sniper rifles. So you get a lot of collateral damage in the gut. Now, the big question is, does that lead to long-term problems? You know, we see that the microbiome shifts upon antibiotic assaults, but it does also bounce back. It's an ecosystem. It has resilience to it. And maybe it takes a lot of dings in order to really throw it off course. So that's something that's being investigated now. I think the critical thing to note with antibiotics is that they have been a massive health good. They have brought a lot of infectious disease under heel, and they have saved countless lives. The thing to note is that we should be using them carefully and judiciously, and that will not only spare the microbes that we rely upon, but it will also delay the rise of drug-resistant infections that are so problematic right now.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Ed Young about the microbiome. He's author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. Ed, you know, we live with pets. They become another family member. Are we sharing microbiomes? Their microbiomes on us? We on them?
Yeah, I think it's almost certainly the case that we do. There are flows of microbes from the creatures and the world around us. And there have been studies showing that homes with dogs in particular have this extra microbial richness. You know, the rest of us live in these quite sanitized homes that are like microbial deserts, and you put a dog in the mix and suddenly the diversity goes up. And that might be good for us. That might give us a wider range of microbes that calibrates our immune system and gets a better balance between reacting, between dealing with infectious threats and then not overreacting. So not just going berserk when we sense harmless things in the world around us.
You know, there was a study out this week that compared asthma rates between Amish and Hutterite communities, and they found a big difference between the two just because, you know, they lived with farm animals differently.
Yeah, so the idea there is that because Amish kids play in these barns, they get exposed to dust, which is really rich in microbes. Their immune systems are better trained for an early age for all the exposures that you get in the wider world. So they get that balance between reaction and overreaction, and that might explain why they have low rates of things like asthma. And this fits with this general idea that early exposures to microbes are a good thing. They help to build and to calibrate the immune system correctly. And it's part of this view of microbes not just as germs, as agents of disease, but as important influences in our lives. And the immune system, not just as this militaristic defense force that kills microbes and, you know, and senses and destroys them, but as like the rangers of a national park whose job it is to manage this ecosystem of lots of different species, chuck out invasive ones, and it's more about control rather than destruction.
How can we control what do we need to feed it? What do we need to feed our microbiome to keep it healthy? And are there certain foods? Does it like to eat more than anything else? Or?
So fiber is a good thing. So fiber consists of a wide range of complex carbohydrates from plants, and that nourishes an equally diverse range of microbes in the gut. Fiber has many other benefits on the microbiome too. So that's one piece of solid advice. many, many animals rely on their microbiome in order to break down these chemicals in plants. You know, humans do to an extent. Something like a cow, you know, something so familiar to us, gets like 70% of its energy from microbial metabolism. That animal would not be able to survive if it didn't have microbes as partners in digestion.
Wow. Give me the answer where I started, Ed. Why do I have 80% different bacteria on one hand than the other?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the answer is kind of we don't know. You know, we're still starting to get to grips about what is it that shapes these ecosystems. You know, so we know that, like, take my body, that my forearm is dry like a desert. The inside of my nose and my mouth is wet and humid like a rainforest. So those physical conditions affect the microbes that get to live in that space. But, you know, if we go broader, if we try to understand what is it that makes this part of the body have these microbes and this one doesn't, we're still starting to answer those questions. And even for, like, you know, my microbiome is very different to yours, which will be very different to those of our listeners. And one big study recently tried to look at the reasons behind those differences, and they could only account for something like 10% of their variation. Well, so we're only starting on this journey.
Well, if you want to read the rest of the journey, it's a great book, Ed. Ed Young's author of The I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and A Grander View of Life. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/microbe. Thank you, Ed, for taking time to be with us today. Support for this podcast comes from Harry's. Ever wonder why shaving is so expensive? Well, you know, it doesn't have to be. You can get a close, comfortable shave at a fraction of the price they charge you at the drugstore. Harry's has a shaving starter set for just $15. That price includes the razor, 3 blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. Here's how Harry's does it. You know, they bought a factory, a razor factory in Germany that has been crafting some of the world's highest quality blades for almost a century. And they ship the blades directly from that factory to you, cutting out the middleman and saving you money. And if you go to harrys.com right now and type in my code FRIDAY with your first purchase, they will give you an additional $5 off. That's HARRYS.com. And enter coupon code FRIDAY at checkout for $5 off the starter set. And start shaving smarter today. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, we're going to the dogs. The English Bulldog. They're a lovable, wrinkly, squishy-faced breed, notorious for health problems. You have your breathing difficulties to overheating, to skin infection and all these furry folds. While the median age is about 8.4 years, many live only 6 years or fewer. Can better breeding give us a better English Bulldog, a breed founded with just 68 dogs in the 1850s, maybe one that doesn't wheeze or overheat or have the highest rate of hip dysplasia in the dog world? Well, that depends on what genes such an inbred breed has to work with. And here to discuss is my guest, a man who has explored what genetic variation has to offer the English Bulldog. Dr. Niels Peterson, he's a distinguished professor emeritus of the veterinary school at the University of California, Davis, and author of new research published late last month. Also with us is Dr. Peter Fotos, science advisor for the Bulldog Club of America, a breeder of French bulldogs. He has a PhD in biomolecular engineering. Welcome to Science Friday, doctors.
Hello, Ira.
Hey, nice to have you both. Dr. Peterson, how hard is it to be an English Bulldog? Well, what's their health like?
Well, their health is not very good if you look overall. They have probably the largest number of health problems across a very broad spectrum, ranging from problems associated with their head structure to problems associated with their bone structure, problems associated with their skin, and problems associated with limited diversity within the genes that regulate the immune system, causing a higher incidence of allergies as well as autoimmune disorders.
Mm-hmm. You looked at about 140 English Bulldogs in your work. What did you conclude about their genetic variation there?
We concluded that they had very limited genetic diversity and that any two bulldogs that we tested were very closely related to each other, and that the amount of diversity, not only did they lack diversity, but the diversity that they had was highly concentrated in certain regions of the genome that were similar between dogs, these large, what we call runs of homozygosity that were that are associated with the very extreme physical traits or abnormalities. I call them abnormalities. The breeders would call them traits.
And so why is this important in determining how healthy a breed can be?
Well, there's been an argument for a long time whether there is enough genetic diversity left in the breed to do what's called reverse genetics, or to actually use the genetics that exist in the breed to improve the breed by selecting back to an earlier form that was healthier. You know, peer breeders really are against outcrossing. Any outcrossing would mongrelize their dogs, and the term mongrel is not a term they like. So basically, what we looked at is the amount of diversity using a number of different parameters, and what we concluded was that they have bred themselves pretty well into a corner and probably do not have enough diversity to use reverse genetics to improve the breed.
Peter Fotos, you're a breeder of French Bulldogs. What's your take on these findings?
I thought it was a great paper. I thought it was a very interesting paper. The interesting thing is if you were to take every breed of dog from the Chihuahua to the Dane, about 200 breeds or so, and put them on a spectrum, and on the left you put the most inbred dog or the most least genetic diversity, and on the right you'd put the ones with the most genetic diversity, you'll actually find, even with Dr. Peterson's work and his numbers, that the bulldog is not at an extreme. It's actually just a little bit left of center. Even when you take into account the effective number of alleles per locus, it's still relatively, there's still a relatively decent number of genes out there that are still workable, especially when you can compare it to, say, the Akita. The Akita is a Japanese breed, a little bit more wolf-looking like, and if you look at its alleles per locus, it's almost the same as the bulldog. Yet the bulldog has achieved a remarkable difference in the way it looks and the size and the shape and its behavior. So, in fact, I would say that the bulldog, given its change, morphology change from a wild village dog to the dog it is today, it's done it in a very few number of steps and as few steps as could be done. The boxer, for example, is a much more tightly bred dog, and it doesn't have as many health problems. And really, the health problems may be due not necessarily to the issue of the genes within the bulldog, but the way it's bred. There's randomly bred dogs, and there's appropriately bred dogs. And dogs that are randomly bred tend to be not as well built, not as good close to the standard as they should be, and therefore they tend to be less healthy. And really, that's a big difference between your average backyard breeder and a responsible good breeder who's breeding towards what the AKC calls the standard.
Niels, would you agree with that?
No, I guess I wouldn't agree with all of it. We have looked at genetic diversity in a number of breeds, and that's available on our Vet Genetics Laboratory website. The Akita has more; it lacks diversity, but it has more diversity than the bulldog does. In fact, we've only found one breed that has less genetic diversity than the bulldog, and that breed, which I can't mention because the research is still ongoing, is actually a performance dog that has started from a much smaller founder population but is very healthy, largely because performance traits are less heritable and the dog is bred for performance, and also the dog still looks very much like a dog. You have to realize that the problem with dogs like the bulldog is that they're bred to these extremes for these certain physical traits that would be considered very abnormal. In other words, brachycephaly is not a normal trait for dogs. Extremely wrinkled skin is not a normal trait. A very abnormal chondrodystrophic skeleton is not a normal trait. And it's not normal to have very little diversity in your genes that control your immune system. So I guess I would have to just gently disagree.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me go to the phones. People are bulldog owners, and they have something to say. Let's go to Ian in Hereford, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ian. Did I get that right?
Close enough.
It's like my name. Yes. Go ahead.
Well, I have a question, and that is that I think it's admirable to try and resolve these issues that you would have in a dog's genetics. But I'm just wondering, at what point in the breeding process do you cross the line into cruel and unusual treatment of a dog simply by bringing it into the world with such extremes? I mean, some dogs have to be born through C-section, and that's like a form of forced surgery, and dogs that are born blind and have many, many defects based on the breeding. And I'm just wondering if, at some point there's got to be a line that's crossed there.
Any response?
So as a breeder, I could tell you that one of the most important things, every breed, the Bulldog Club of America being no exception, has what's called a standard of what a bulldog is and what are the components that make a bulldog a bulldog. And there are a lot of breeders out there that try to breed to the standard as carefully as possible. If you do breed to that standard, the dog tends to be very healthy. And if you breed for color, for example, people who just try to breed a fancy colored bulldog, or someone in their backyard that has a little female dog and they want to have litters, they'll breed to a random stud. That's when you get into trouble, because you don't understand the genetics and you don't understand what's behind the dog. Any responsible breeder will know exactly if there is, for example, juvenile cataracts that could run in the lines. We genetically test for that, and any dogs that are carriers typically aren't bred. So the line really should be one: if you don't know what you're doing, you shouldn't do it. And people who do know what they're doing are extremely careful. They keep extremely good records. They know their pedigrees. They know what an inbreeding is acceptable, what levels of inbreeding, when to outcross. And they do try to outcross as far as possible, but still within the breed. These are done all the time by very responsible breeders.
Hmm. The UK Kennel Club made some changes to the breed standard following major controversy over the bulldog health in 2009. Is there anything about the breed standard that could be changed to make the bulldog healthier?
Ira, can I make some comments?
Yes, Neil.
As a veterinarian, my first concern is the health of the dogs. And what we want to see are dogs that are going to live a normal lifespan and die from the normal type of degenerative and old age diseases that one would expect. And I would argue that the line is crossed when a breed can't run freely, a breed can't breathe freely, a breed can't reproduce freely, and a breed can't be free of things that affect its immune system. And so in all of those categories, bulldogs do not run freely, they do not breathe freely, they do not breed freely, and they have problems with their immune systems and other things as well. So where you cross a line depends on how you look at it. I'm sure that many veterinarians would say that line has been crossed long time ago.
I will come back with,
the bulldog was originally bred to be a sporting dog and to bull bait. And 200 years ago, it was bred to run and attack bulls and be courageous and brave. The bulldog's purpose has changed dramatically then. And if you look at other companion breeds, French bulldogs, Pekingese can't run. They're not designed to run. And a bulldog is not designed to run. Having said that, I've seen many bulldogs that are in agility that can run and jump and do plenty of things. And these all tend to be well-bred bulldogs, bulldogs that have been very well-bred to the correct lines, outcrossed when appropriate, inbred when appropriate. And that's how they arrived at those, not through just a random, I want a lilac bulldog, and therefore I'm going to try to find another lilac bulldog to get to that, regardless of the other traits of the dog.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Neil, did you want to jump in there?
Yes, the problem is the standard. They keep going back to this standard. And it's true that every breed creates a standard when it's first created. A group of dogs are brought in that meet that standard. And then the breed is closed for any further genetic introgressions, basically forever. And that's where the term purebred comes from. So you have to start with a large genetic base, and that genetic base has to be very healthy to start with. Now, the problem with the standard, and it's already been mentioned, that these were dogs that were created to be very athletic and bait bulls, which was eventually outlawed in the 19th century by the British Parliament. But this standard was made, and if you look at those dogs, and in our paper, we did include websites that give images of the dog since the earliest time, since it was bull baiting to the present time. And that standard may have been set in stone, but the dogs have changed dramatically, because what happens is breeders breed to the extremes of the standard, so they keep pushing that standard. So a standard is much like the Constitution of the United States. If you have Supreme Court justices that hold the line and do not allow that standard to change very much, that Constitution is one thing. But when you have show judges that are continuously changing the standard by declaring a new type of dog a champion, which then sets a signal for everybody else, that standard is a moving target. It is not a constitution in a constitutional sense.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phone. So David in St. Michael's, Maryland. Hi, David.
Hi, Ira. Ira, 45 years ago, I set out to reproduce the healthy, agile bulldog of 1820, who had longer legs than today's English bulldog, less extreme shoulders. They had tails, and they had longer noses. And as has been said, they were an agile dog. I have dogs now that are competing at active sports, service dogs, search and rescue. I even have one doing bed bug detection in Switzerland. All of my dogs have been health screened before they've been given permission to breed. I've been at this for 45 years. I called the breed Old English Bulldog, D-O-G-G-E, and people infringed on my name. I bred a purebred dog, and so my line is now called Levitt Bulldogs. And you know,
All right. Well, there it can be done, I guess, if you want to bring back the bulldogs. I can't get a commercial in here for his bulldogs. We run out of time. I want to thank Dr. Niels Peterson, Distinguished Professor Emeritus, University of California, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Peter Fotos breeds French bulldogs, is science advisor for the Bulldog Club of America. Gentlemen, thank you for taking time to be with us today. One last thing before we go. Early this week, we got word that Nobel Prize-winning chemist Ahmed Zewail, a professor of Caltech, has passed away. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1999 for his work in femtoscience. That's using a high-speed laser to catch glimpses of atoms in motion. I talked to him a few days after the prize announcement in 1999 about creativity in science.
There is really no master plan that one starts and writes on a piece of paper that we're going to discover this and then we discover it. This is not the way it's done in science. The way we do it is to ask a fundamental question, and we did about 20 years ago, being curious and interested in understanding how, for example, energy moves in molecules, what makes molecules break bonds or forms bonds, and as you do this, and if you have the right scientific base, lasers are developing, other techniques are developing, and so by asking the right questions and having the right people, you can keep advancing your vision until we came to the point in 1987 where we actually saw for the first time how a molecule, what's really how the atoms in the behavior of a chemical reaction change with time. And so it's a whole long process, but of course, when some of us can make a breakthrough like this, it becomes extremely enjoyable and fundamentally important.
Nobel-winning chemist Ahmed Zewail, professor of Caltech, passing away at the age of 70 years old. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Of course, we're talking all week long on our website also. We tweet and Facebook and all kinds of places there. Just a reminder that our gala is coming up October 15th on the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum in New York. It's big, the famous aircraft carrier. We're going to have a lot of fun October 15th. That's Saturday night in October. Go to our website, sciencefriday.com/gala, for information about getting tickets for it. It's going to be the hottest ticket in New York. Hard to believe that Science Friday's first broadcast was 25 years ago. That's right, this is our silver anniversary. And to commemorate our amazing journey, we're hosting a gala event on October 15th at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum here in New York City. It'll be a celebration of everything we've done for the past 25 years with special guests like Alan Alda, Brian Greene, and more. And you are invited. So head over to sciencefriday.com/gala to find out more and to reserve your ticket. You don't want to miss this.